from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Los Angeles Times reporter Richard Morosi spent 18 months traveling across nine Mexican states where he met with workers at the giant mega farms exporting much of the produce sold in the United States. He joins us to discuss his investigation, which chronicles in a four-part series vulnerable farm workers living under harsh conditions. And you can actually read that investigation and those four parts on our website by going to kqed.org. Richard Morosi, again, is with the L.A. Times, and he did this with a photographer named Dom Bartoletti. And Richard Morosi, good to have you on Forum. Welcome. Richard Morosi, are you there? There are gremlins at work here this morning. We had this in the first half hour. We're trying to connect to Richard Morosi, who is in San Diego. Let me just say that by way of introduction, there are a record level of exports coming into the United States. There have been technological and sanitation advancements, but really what this series of articles focuses on are the workers. And essentially it says that the workers are, that the produce is treated better than the workers, to put it bluntly. Do we have Richard Morosi on the line
there? Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, good. Okay. Welcome to the program. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me on. Good morning.
Good morning. Let's talk about sort of the overview first. I mean, agribusiness is doing a lot of business down south of the border, and Mexican suppliers have actually supposedly committed themselves to decent treatment and decent living conditions for workers. But as you discovered, there are thousands of farm workers who are, well, to use your language, exploited and suffering extreme hardship.
Yeah, I don't think most Americans realize at this point, but half of the tomatoes we consume here now come from Mexico. Also, huge amounts of cucumbers, bell peppers, chili peppers, melons, you name it. So Mexico has turned into a very important supplier of produce to the U.S., and every big American company down there sources significant amounts, every major retail chain, every major supermarket chain, and restaurant chain. So, this boom has occurred roughly in the past 10 years. And all of these American companies have these vendor codes of conduct, social responsibility guidelines that list the decent treatment of anybody supplying in their supply chain, decent sanitary living conditions, compliance with all labor laws. And I went down there and found that I found little evidence that these guidelines are being enforced down there.
Yeah, you found that, it reminds me of Tennessee Ernie Ford, that many of them owe their souls to the company store, and there are wages withheld illegally, and there are rat-infested camps, some without reliable water supply or even functioning toilets. There are guards, there's barbed-wired fences, threats of violence. And these are major U.S. companies that really just aren't, from your articles at least and from your reportage, aren't doing enough to enforce these guidelines of social responsibility.
No, and I went to a lot of these labor camps to see on the conditions. It wasn't easy getting access to the laborers or the conditions, so we just went there and started talking to people. I talked to 100 of these folks who are some of the poorest people in North America. They are bused hundreds of miles from these poor mud hut villages, largely indigenous people. Many of them don't even speak Spanish. And they get to these labor camps, and they're seasonal workers. They stay 3-4 months, sometimes 6-7 months. And they are pretty much tethered to these camps in many ways. In some camps, they withhold their wages against the law for up to 3 months. In other camps, they fall deep into debt at the company store and are not allowed to leave until they pay their debt. So they fall into this kind of cycle of deepening debt that keeps them there. And it's convenient for the agribusinesses because, you know, they keep working and producing so that they can meet this huge demand here in the United States.
And they're working 6 days a week for the equivalent of $8 to $12 a day. Do I have that right? In most cases. And the recruitment from these indigenous areas continues to go on. And in many instances, as we said, wages aren't paid or they're not paid till the end. And yet we hear from some of those, at least that you talk to, that, for example, the barbed-wired fences or the keeping of wages are done for the workers' own good. The barbed-wired fences keep out thieves and drug dealers, and the earnings are held so they're not going to get robbed or they won't drink it up or have violence visited upon them.
Yeah, that's the excuse they give, right, to justify this system. It is Sinaloa. It is a lot of these places I went are controlled by organized crime. So some of it may appear plausible from the outside, but you have to remember these folks, you know, know, they don't have any money, so they're not going to be real the target of thieves. And so you have to look at the other possibilities, what the labor is telling. Well, and the reality that they can't leave through the front gate if they owe money. And the fact that if they leave, say, 6 months, 6 weeks into a contract that pays them at the end of that contract, they forfeit their wages, right? But sometimes the conditions are so unbearable that they do hop the fence and they flee. Escapes from these camps are very common. It's usually young folks who can maybe manage their way and find another farm. But for people with families, that's not a possibility, right? So these barbed wire fences, the guards, these debts all, you know, work to effectively trap them inside the camp.
We're talking to Richard Morrissey, who is a reporter with the L.A. Times, who led an 18-month investigative series called Product of Mexico with photographer Don Bartelli. And you can read them on our website by going to kqed.org/forum. There's also the fact that many of them have no beds, and yet, again, the argument is, well, you know, this is because these workers would dismantle them for firewood. Many came from regions where they sleep on the floor anyway.
I found, you know, that was a go-to excuse for a lot of these agribusinesses. Blame the culture, right? Blame the culture of these people, that they enjoy bathing in irrigation canals, that they enjoy sleeping on the floors, that this is just how it was, and it's better here than it was in their home villages. But I went to these home villages. You know, they have mud huts, but, you know, they're airy, they're spacious, they're not overcrowded, they're not bug-infested or rat-infested. And what they'll tell you, yeah, they live better at home, they just don't have a means to pay for a lot of food. And the whole, it was a ridiculous notion that they, you know, chop up the beds for firewood. The reason they did that in this camp was because they don't have stoves. They're not even provided stoves. So you'll see people cooking over open fires, you know, to warm up their little tortillas, the little food that they get. So they're doing it for a reason. It's just deeply entrenched, you know, kind of in many ways sometimes discriminatory attitudes toward these folks.
And frankly, the reason there's so much bathing in irrigation canals is clean water is in short supply.
Well, the running water is out of supply in a lot of these camps, right? They run out of water. The water gets trucked in, and, you know, there's hundreds of people living in these camps. It runs out. And so these folks, with their babies, with their kids, everybody, the whole family out there bathing in and shampooing up in these irrigation canals, many of them which are dirty. And in some of them, they've got water snakes, you know. And people panic. They see the snakes, they jump out. And this is after a long day of work, right? So what struck me was the level of misery, you know, that their basic needs aren't even being met. I mean, nobody expects, everybody knows, farm workers are not going to live good, great lives, right? It's not the Ritz-Carlton. Nobody expects them to live in the Ritz-Carlton, right? But it was just that the basics weren't even met. You know, beds, you know, a clean living environment, freedom to move around, running water, things like this, you know. And they're working for some of the biggest corporate, you know, they're part of the supply chain that's generating billions of dollars for some of the biggest corporations in the U.S.
And what about the overseeing? What about agribusiness? The corporations here in the United States, which talk about social responsibility and human rights and seem to at least make attempts to be good corporate citizens. I know when Walmart goes down there, they warn them in advance and the camps clean up their acts. But for the most part, where's the culpability for oversight in terms of U.S. companies?
There hasn't been, and largely because there's lack of a public awareness of the situation down there. Other industries who source in Southeast Asia and the apparel and footwear and garment industries, they've had to do, you know, really enforce their standards through verification, through third-party auditors, right, after there was a lot of public awareness brought to it, right? In Mexico, there hasn't been that. So there hasn't been that kind of pressure on these companies from consumer groups and other groups to enforce their own standards, right? There hasn't been a story up to this point on this, largely because me and my colleagues have been busy covering the drug war and really haven't taken a hard look at the conditions of some of these folks. And then the past 10 years, we've experienced an export boom. You know, the amount of produce exports have tripled, so it kind of snuck up on us, and it was time to to really take a look, and what I found really shocked me.
Well, you also found, or I believe pretty much clarified for your readers, that it's going to be harder to cut back on this abuse than, for example, in Bangladesh, where there were factory fires and a building collapse that killed over 1,000 people just in recent years, because we're talking about Mexican farmers in remote areas, and we're talking about farms that are distant from one another. And I'm kind of also wondering, how did you get access to some of these camps, and was it dangerous for you?
It was risky at times. You know, the coverage took me to these places. I needed to know. So I went with Don Bartletti, Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer, and we'd show up at these camps intending to just talk to a lot of folks, and we talked to hundreds of people. And at one point, you know, they'd say, hey, come on inside. So we would, you know, these places are generally off limits. Human rights folks have had trouble getting access, other journalists, union folks forbidden to go in. And we said, hey, they're inviting us inside. So we would go inside and we'd start talking. We'd see the conditions, document the conditions. Inevitably, we would, you know, the camp supervisors or guards would be alerted and we'd be escorted out. But we did this in a number of places and really got a good sense of how these folks are living. Often we would just hang outside the camps and just talk to these people. Nobody talks to these folks. They're Mexico's invisible people. They're the poorest people. They're peasants. They're indigenous people. And they don't have a voice. They don't have a champion. They don't have unions. And so these stories would pour out in sometimes very pithy ways. One young man said at a camp where they get fed two bowls of lentil soup a day and they're working 10 hours, he says, we come here fat and we leave skinny. You know, simple statement like that really says it all.
You had translators, because some of them just speak their indigenous language, right?
No, the young folks speak Spanish. So,
oh, they do. Yeah.
And most of the folks do speak Spanish. I didn't have too much of a problem. And the older folks are illiterate, but I would get their names very carefully and write them down. And a lot of these folks come from a region called La Huasteca, which is 200 miles north of Mexico City, which is one of the poorest parts of Mexico.
Well, what does this tell us about, for example, fair trade labels on foods, if anything? And what also I'm wondering about is there was an article by Susan Marcus that you might have seen about the Fair Food Program in Florida, which was spearheaded by a coalition. And they're talking, a lot of tomato picking down there. They're talking about wage increases of 50% to 70% and optimal field conditions and no wage theft or wage fraud and no sexual assaults. And it's because workers, growers, and buyers have essentially gotten together and established hotlines and established rapid investigations and market consequences. I mean, why not talk to agribusiness about really getting something along those lines going?
You know, that those reforms in Florida were revolutionary. They're great and groundbreaking, and everybody signed on. But, and I talked to some of the Florida growers, they say their good efforts are being undermined by these same companies actually increasing sourcing from Mexico, right, where there aren't these kind of extra costs associated with labor or labor reforms. And so they were really concerned that this whole effort was just going to go for naught with increased imports from Mexico, and we're seeing that, right? It's hard to actually prove it, but something's going on. They're going down there and sourcing more and more of their produce down there. We don't have, you know, the labor issue is not an issue. There's just weak labor laws, little to no enforcement of labor laws by the Mexican government, and these third parties.
Richard, I mean, you can't, under Mexican law, you can't withhold these wages and not pay them. But the law is being defied all the time.
It's amazing. I sat down with a Mexican official, right? And I sat and I told him, why does this exist? He told me he insisted that it was legal, that they do this so the folks can save and they don't spend it on drinking. And he was telling me it's legal. You know, it's like Alice in Wonderland down there. I mean, it's highly illegal to do that, right? And even the labor folks don't know the law. And no one's enforcing it on the U.S. side. And what happens is there's plenty of representatives from U.S. firms at Mexican agribusiness, okay? But they're focused in the fields and the packing plant to make sure that food is good quality and it's safe for American consumers. And they do a really good job of that because the Mexican produce is very good, it's high quality, and it's generally safe, right? But they don't go into the labor camps. They largely ignore the labor camps and the labor conditions. They're not focused on that.
Talking to Richard Morosi, who is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times and who led an 18-month investigative series called Product of Mexico with photographer Don Bartletti, and that series is now on our website, kqed.org/forum. Richard Morosi is with us from San Diego, and one of the biggest growers, just kind of supporting what we just heard, Bioparques de Occidente, which is in Jalisco, actually withheld wages and kept hundreds of workers against their will in a labor camp. This is all against Mexican law, of course. Actually beat some who tried to escape, and that's according to laborers and according to Mexican authorities. So the laws, like a lot of laws in Mexico, are simply not enforced or just on the books. I'd like to invite listener response, and you can join us now. In fact, we welcome your calls with any questions or comments you have or reactions to what you've heard or concerns that you may want to express about what you've heard. You can join us at our toll-free number. That's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls and invite them. Again, 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, and you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. Here's a question, Richard Morosi, from a listener named Ben, and says, which were the three worst camps and what were the companies associated with them so I can stop buying their products? In other words, people want to know what they can do.
Well, one of the challenges for this story is finding a representative sample of camps. I visited 30, right? There are thousands of camps, but there are hundreds of big exports, right, farms. And I focused on the ones that generally had the better reputations, that had been given social responsibility awards and were partnered with some of America's biggest companies. So I figure if I go to see conditions at the best ones, I'd get a good gauge. And at some of these best ones, I found pretty bad living conditions overall, right? So I'm thinking to myself, well, what are the worst ones like? What are the ones like that don't get social responsibility recognition, right? Some of the main ones I went to were Rene Produce. That place had issues with people sleeping in irrigation canals, bathing in irrigation canals, sleeping on cardboard scraps, falling into deep debt at the company store. This Rene Produce was given an award for Exporter of the Year by Mexican President Peña Nieto. They exported 200 million pounds of tomatoes alone last year. Their clients are some of the biggest American firms, you name it.
What kind of responses did you get from some of these big American firms to the
questions?
Well,
they either don't respond or they say they're going to review their policies and impose, restrictions and then reinforce their guidelines. Walmart, in this case, which is a big recipient of produce from Rene Produce, said that there were fire safety issues that they're going to ask them to correct and that they were going to fix other issues. They were always very vague in their answers. They didn't provide me any interviews, so I could ask more questions about if they were aware of these conditions down there and how can it exist if they have a social responsibility team down there that is in charge of looking into these camps. Walmart is one of the few that has a social responsibility team, but I was on the ground in some of these camps where this team supposedly went, and I found some of these conditions, so at least I was wondering, what are they doing down here, Rene also supplies some to Target for a while for Whole Foods, and Whole Foods actually sent a statement saying that they were very concerned with the conditions that I found there and that they were going to look into the matter. And some of these other firms, Safeway, they didn't provide me an interview either, but they said they were going to look into each of these points. Albertsons declined to comment. Subway said that they were going to reinforce their guidelines and look into each of these concerns, and so with Darden Restaurants, which has the Olive Garden chain.
Let me bring some of our callers on to the program. Billy, you're first up. Good morning.
Good morning. Like your first commenter, I too want to know what I can do. As a consumer, I feel like I am complicit in the process, and I wonder about my own culpability. It's beyond journalism to comment on my culpability, but I would appreciate knowing what my next steps are. Thanks.
Okay, some suggestions, Richard Morosi?
Yeah, I've been getting that question a lot. There's
I bet
no
you
clear
have, huh?
mechanism into that. In the Florida case, there is a group called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a union group, that exerted lots of pressure on those growers to improve living conditions. And they did so by pressuring the companies. And they picketed and boycotted and eventually got this far-reaching agreement. that doesn't exist in Mexico. There's nobody, there's no real one group that's looking out for their care. So that's a really good question. Aside from calling some of these retailers and asking them, pressing them, there's no real set way to do it at this point. I'm going to look into, in my next stories, what are some of the solutions that some of these folks are looking into. Certainly, the certification bodies that go out there verifying these social responsibility guidelines now feel that they're going to have more leverage over these retailers into at least going out there now, because with this story, they feel that some of these retailers have a reputational problem now.
Well, with the I mentioned the fair trade label before. I mean, does this cast any doubt on that, or concerns that consumers ought to have?
Yeah, the fair trade label doesn't have. They don't. They've only signed up a few farms down there. It was just non-existent. This whole third-party auditing system down there that's so prevalent in garment factories and other factories in Southeast Asia doesn't exist in Mexico, right? It's purely voluntary, and there hasn't been pressure up until this point for them to do anything. So fair trade, I think, only has signed up 20 farms down in Mexico. Although they think, the stories like this could help them force retailers into signing up and getting more verification.
With an investigative series like you put out, there's always some pushback or blowback, and I wonder if you've been hearing from some of these food companies that, we're doing really good work down there, socially responsible kinds of things, and you didn't cover that enough.
Well, yeah, I got pushback from the Arizona distributors. Much of the produce that comes from Mexico goes through Nogales, Arizona, and there are huge largely American distributors that, you know, ship the stuff to all corners of the United States. Those folks were very upset with my reporting, and they put out actually a talking points memo to all of their members in anticipation of my story, warning members and giving them talking point examples, how to respond, that these Mexican folks are socially responsible, they're multi-generational families that really care about their workers, and it's all good talk and everything, but if you see it from a distance, you tend to believe it, but when you see it up close, you see that it's not true in many cases, right? I found a couple of good growers, but I saw many of the growers, the most esteemed growers, had significant issues, right? So now this Arizona group, the Fresh Produce Association of America, has announced this Alliance for Social Responsibility, where they're going to increase their attention on some of these issues. But without, you know, outside pressure, without some kind of independent bodies, you know, or some kind of teeth to these things, I really question whether they're committed to it.
Let me bring on another caller, and that's Teresa. Teresa, join us.
Hi. I have two comments. First of all, I grew up in Jamaica, where I was aware as a child that we had, Jamaicans going to do farm work in the United States. And the thing is, these same concerns, and I am 50 years old, I was hearing about this when I was 10 in my teenage years, and these same concerns were being highlighted by the farmers who would travel to the United States to work on the farms here. So, you know, this situation has been long in existence, and it's systemic among large corporations. The question I have is, why is it that, you know, these corporations, when they go into other countries, although they're doing the same thing in the United States, why aren't they being required to treat workers to the same high standards that regular workers in the United States are treated to? Why are they allowed to operate in this underhand, illegal way and treat people as indentured servants? This is so wrong, and this needs to be addressed, you know, because growing up, I've seen it. I see how vulnerable poor people are, how hard they work, and how they're constantly being abused by these large companies who tout themselves as, you know, these leaders in society and have all this power and this.
Yeah,
and
Teresa,
that.
Excuse me, you're raising an important question here, and I'd like to go right to it with Richard Morosi. In fact, I'm looking at an email here from Larry who says it's important to point out this issue isn't confined to Mexico. A recently released documentary, Food Chains, by Sanjay Rawal, exposes abuses on farms in Florida. The fact is, though, that we're talking about sovereign states where this goes on that are not the United States of America. And I'm wondering, Richard Morosi, if therefore what we're really talking about, despite Florida's problems or problems in other parts internally here in the United States, of a double standard that obviously exists.
Well, you know, it's an old story, you know, and the thing is these folks seek out cheap labor, right? And they found this great source of cheap labor over there, and they're keeping costs down, and American consumers don't have to pay a lot at the supermarket, right? And unless these issues are exposed and talked about, these companies aren't going to be really focusing on this, right? As long as they get the produce at a cheap price, I mean, that's their goal ultimately, right? If they're forced to act, then they will act. But I don't see any evidence that they're really acting to you know, look in and enforce their guidelines.
Yeah, but they're spending, as you point out, a lot of money on technology and sanitation in terms of the produce itself. In fact, you read your articles and you realize that the produce is treated far better than the people who work.
Well, think about it. I mean, the produce is eaten by U.S. consumers, right? And it's ultimately about protecting your brand and satisfying your consumer, right? So they're really, really intent on making that sure that food is safe and it's good, right? Because ultimately that their whole reputation is staked on that. But to the extent that laborers are living, you know, stark existence down there, it's not known. It's not known to the public, and they can get away with not paying much attention to it.
And another listener who wants to know how much of this may be a result of NAFTA and do you suggest maybe no longer buying produce from Mexico?
No, I don't suggest that at all. I mean, these are jobs, and they're much-needed jobs down there. It's just a matter of providing the basics. And one thing that I've noticed is that it just doesn't seem like it would cost them a lot of money to give them beds and, you know, give them a little bit better to eat, food to eat, and better living conditions, more running water. To me, it's just they're nickel and diming them, you know, and it doesn't make any sense to me. There's just such intense pressure to compete on price that, you know, every penny, every peso down there is really guarded. I mean, and so it's a matter of really raising the consciousness of these companies and maybe pressuring them to just provide the basic things. And the bottom line is I don't think it's going to really impact their profits that much because these are not really super expensive items.
Well, we'll leave it there, and we thank you, Richard Morosi. Again, you can read the articles on our website. There's a link, kqed.org/forum, to Product of Mexico, which was done by Richard Morosi and photographer Don Bartelli. Bartletti's work is on there, too, as well. I thank, again, Richard Morosi for being with us. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.